So this is a fascinating theme that emerges in the scripture where when you turn to the pages of Genesis chapter 1, and there's this strange oddity that God created the great sea monsters, that it causes us to think, well, is he talking about whales or some type of animal like that that's in the ocean? And then you begin to see as you move through the scriptures that that is a mythological motif that is picked up off of Genesis chapter 1 that turns into a dragon-like creature. And sometimes it's on a huge scale and it's given the name Leviathan or Rahab, but sometimes it's shrunk down to be like a serpent or a snake. And so what we've looked at is this theme that keeps emerging over and over, whether it's tempting Adam and Eve or whether it is a threat like we saw last week in the vision of Daniel, this dream of Daniel of four great beasts that come out of the waters that characterize some of the empires that are threatened the existence of the nation of Israel, you're beginning to see that these biblical authors in many ways at times picture the great sea monster as just that, a creature from God. But at other times, it is characterized like a dragon, as something that is fierce. And so there's these tensions that are kind of set up in the scripture utilizing these same word pictures. Now, the dragon is something that lots of people and civilizations have tried to use to explain the mysteries of life. And so the way I would like for you to see it, as we talk about some dragon schemes this morning. So last week we looked at dragon dreams. Today we're going to look at dragon schemes. And next week we're going to finish in the book of Revelation. We're going to talk about dragon teams in the sense that it's also seen as kind of a network of influences and powers that often threaten the hope of humanity. But what you'll see here on this particular chart is a summarization using that Hebrew word I introduced to you a few weeks back called tanin. This Hebrew word, this great sea creature in Genesis chapter 1 begins to morph into the serpent in Genesis 3, Leviathan in Job 41, Rahab in Isaiah 51, into the wild beasts of the dreams of Daniel in chapter 7 of Daniel, and then you come to the New Testament. And it's interesting that this same concept now is kind of summarized in a term called the Satan. Now, many times when we hear that word Satan, we think of it almost like a proper name, Satan, okay? But technically, translation-wise, ha-satan means the adversary, one who opposes. So it's not so much this idea of a person as much as it is a force, something that we all struggle with in life, of being accused or accusing other people or blaming other people or being blamed. And it's those type of things that we see taking place in the text. And then it gets characterized with a proper name, Satan. Now, here's a way I can help you understand this. Isn't it interesting how we give names to hurricanes, right? Okay, you have Hurricane Katrina. That's a number of years ago. Hurricane Helene, you know, Hurricane Andrew, whatever it may be. It might be a woman's name. It might be a man's name. It's a way for us to identify a force that is approaching that could be possibly deadly and certainly dangerous and always destructive. So it's a complex network of things that we give a name to. And so a hurricane can be a storm, but it's more than a storm. It takes on a persona. Do you remember Hurricane Katrina? Do you remember how much destruction? Do you remember how life-threatening was? You know, oh yeah, Hurricane Katrina. Well, It's not that the hurricane is a person. Are you following what I'm saying? It's a characterization of something. And the name Satan, when it's in capital letters in your Bible, is really a way of kind of characterizing what we have seen all along, that life is full of these potential dangers that can set us off course. So you might say the name becomes the costume, okay, for us to identify it. Just like in a hurricane, Katrina is the costume that is put on this complex force that brings danger to certain people in certain parts of the country. Satan, when we talk about it, is not so much an anthropological character. In other words, Satan is not going to walk through that back door with horns and a pitchfork, okay? It's this force that has been with humanity since the beginning of time, and we put a name on it because it keeps popping up. There is this draconian experience in human life where we find that we are always at each other's throat, and we are often tempted to blame others or accuse others, that it's been part of the human story since the beginning of time. And so, who or what is Satan is a good question. Think of the word Satan not so much as a proper name, but think of it as a culmination of chaotic influences that we encounter in this life. And we give it this costume so that we can identify it. So even now, when we watch the news, when we read, does anybody still read the newspaper, you know, or look online, we go, ooh, that's satanic, right? Or maybe it's kissing cousin, that's demonic, right? So a lot of times what we do is we characterize certain things as a way of identifying it, that this is not what God intended. This wasn't a part of the original creation. This is not good. This is not Eden. This is not what God intended when he made us in his image. Now, are there ways that this influence at times becomes personal? Yes. When you look at the New Testament, you'll find people many times in the ministry of Jesus who have been oppressed by the demonic or the satanic or whatever. Now, what's difficult is to figure out, are those emotional and psychological illnesses that are using the characterization of Satan? Or is it truly a spiritual type of influence that is holding people down and making their lives miserable? So, where do we get the personification of Satan? Well, I think it comes from the story of Job, primarily. Now, most of you are familiar with this story of Job. If I was to say to you, what is the book of Job all about? You would say suffering, right? More than likely, you would say suffering. Job is this righteous individual that has a lot of blessings in life. He's rich. He has a good family. He has a lot of kids. And he is enjoying the good life. And in chapters 1 and 2 of the book of Job, we have a strange scene. We have what is like a heavenly council boardroom, where the angelic beings come into the presence of God, and there is one there that is called the Ha-Satan, not a name of an individual, as much as one that is characterized by accusation. Now, the dragon's scheme is this. Most people really follow God out of fear or what they can get out of God. That's the accusation that is made by this Satan, okay? So the Satan comes into the presence of God, and God is kind of bragging on Job. Here's my trophy of righteousness. He's a good man. He's blameless, the text tells us. And we shouldn't doubt that. He really was a good man. He was blameless. He dedicated his life, and he would even offer up sacrifice on the behalf of his family just in case they did something wrong, okay? So he was looking out for their welfare as well. The Hasatan comes into the presence of God and says, you know what? The only reason Job is as blameless as you are saying he is because of what he can get out of you. You just keep pouring all these blessings out on him. And if you took those blessings away, he would curse you. He would turn against you. He would hate you. And then something strange happens. God says, well, let's put Job to the test. Go ahead, take away those things, and let's see what happens. So the book of Job will refer to the Hasatan in chapters 1 and 2, but later it changes imagery to Leviathan and Rahab. And what we find here is it's all a part of this influence that the text of Job seems to be wrestling with. And what Job himself is wrestling with is, I don't know what I did wrong. We all face that at times when life goes south, when we can't figure out why A caused B. We then look to God and say, why is God doing this to me? Right? It's just part of the natural human expression that we have. And so the Hasatan accuses Job of being a gold digger. He only worships God for what he can get out of him. And to summarize shortly, God says, go ahead, take those blessings away, only you can't take his life. And so the Hasatan brings all kinds of calamities upon Job. He loses his children. He loses his property. And then he loses his health. And Job has three friends that can't figure out what Job did wrong. Because they have in their mind, if something goes wrong, you must have sinned against God. And so the majority of the book, really, is all about this interaction between Job and his friends because Job is maintaining his innocence. But the accusation that you see in chapters 1 and 2 by the Hasatan becomes the temptation in those three friends who then say, come on, Job, fess up. Confess. What did you do wrong? Because you're experiencing all this calamity, you must have done something wrong. And there becomes the draconian scheme, you might say, to throw accusation on other people and to say, if you had not done something wrong, why are you going through the suffering that you're going through? So what happens now is the book is then Job wrestling with all this emotion. And he knows that he didn't do anything to deserve all that he's going through, but he doesn't have an explanation. And so the book turns, and it's a long, long book, 42 chapters, and it's all in poetry. And you kind of go, oh my gosh, how do you get through all of this? How do you make sense of it? Well, you come to the end of the book, and what you find is Job finally stands up one day and he says, if I could get an audience with God, if I could take God to court, I could force him to give me an explanation as to why I'm going through all that I'm going. So at the end of the book, God says, okay, Job, let's have at it. You can ask me, you can put me on trial. No problem, but I want to ask you a question first, okay? Before you begin putting me on trial, I have a little question for you as well. So at the end of the book of Job, you come to the end, and God uses the dragon as a way of him finally coming to a place where he can't comprehend, but at the same time he can't accuse God of mistreating him. Because the answer that God gives to Job is unfathomable. And here's what he says. So you move ahead, and here's what it says in chapter 41. He says, "Can you pull in Leviathan with a fish hook?" Now, by now, this metaphor is such that is a terrifying monster. There's no one that wants to put a hook on the end of a line and catch it, right? Okay. "Can you tie down its tongue with a rope?" These are rhetorical questions. What's the implied answer to this? No. No, I can't do that. "Can you put a cord through its nose or pierce its jaw with a hook?" No. Will it keep begging you for mercy? Will it speak to you with gentle words? No, no. "Will it make an agreement with you for you to take it as your slave for life?" No. "Can you make a pet of it like a bird or put it on a leash for the young women in your house?" No, 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 no. And you can see, it just keeps going down. "Will traders barter for it?" No. "Can you fill its hide with harpoons or its head with fishing spears?" No, no, no. Just read chapter 41. It is quite entertaining. But what's the purpose of it? By the time you get to the end of it, and this isn't even the entirety of the chapter, basically this picture by William Blake, it's called Behemoth and Leviathan. It was actually painted in 1825. Shows these creatures that no human being can control. And as a result of that, Job wakes up and the light turns on and he goes, I spoke of things that are far too complex for me to understand. And the point is, God is saying, if you can't understand how to simply catch a Leviathan, how are you going to understand the complexities of life itself, of free will, of destiny, of things behind the things? Are you following what I'm saying? We can only understand life to a certain point, and then we embrace it as it comes, and there's no way really for us to figure out. So while God is not really obligated to give Job an answer, the conversation goes like this. Job says, "Why?" The friends say, "You sinned." Job says, "No, I didn't." And then God says, "Look at these cool animals." Really a strange book, but powerful. Because what it is saying is there are things that are going to happen in life that are beyond our control, number one, beyond our understanding, number two. And all that we can do is trust that God, who stands behind the circumstances of life, will indeed hold me, protect me, and accept me, because that's the kind of God that he is. So basically, in the book of Job, the language that God uses speaks of the raging sea and the chaotic monsters. This turns back a couple chapters. And regarding the cosmic sea, God says, Who shut in the sea with doors when it burst out from the womb and prescribed bounds for it and set bars and doors and said, thus far you shall come and no farther, and here shall your proud waves be stopped. What that is saying is God is telling Job, I know you don't understand, but it's under my control. When I want the waves to stop, I'll make it stop. When I want to put Leviathan down, I'll put it down. So maybe the best way we can summarize we finite humans have no way of knowing the innumerable variances and variables that would explain things as to why they happen the way they happen. Whether we're speaking of human decisions or angelic decisions or the flap of butterfly wings, the creation is far too vast and complex for us to get our minds around. And yet in every detail, it does affect the course of things, at least in small ways. So today, the small little decisions you make will determine a lot of different things. If you decide to keep driving even though your fuel light comes on, telling you you need gas, well, you can pull in and fill up and keep going, or eventually you're going to run dry alongside the road. The smallest things affect us. So the temptation becomes, though, and here's the draconian scheme, is to either blame God or blame others for my circumstances in life. So I want to give you one other thing to think about. I want you to think about the temptation of Jesus. There's a pretty long account in Matthew chapter 4. It talks about three temptations that the Hasatan, the accuser, comes and basically accuses Jesus that he, like Job, is far too trusting of God, but the Hasatan has better things to offer. If you'll do this, if you'll do this, if you'll worship me, I'll give you the kingdoms of the world. And each time Jesus quotes from the Old Testament and resists the dragon scheme to give up his integrity in the process. There's a short little thing in Mark. Doesn't elaborate on the three temptations Matthew does, but it adds an interesting thing. So here's the verse, Mark 1:12. And the Spirit immediately drove him, Jesus, into the wilderness. He was in the wilderness 40 days, tempted by Satan. So now it's using it as a proper name. Do you see this? By the time you get to the New Testament, the Hasatan of the Old Testament is taking on the costume of an individual, Satan. And so translators are now starting to capitalize it as a proper name. Tempted by Satan, and then this is the interesting thing. He was with the wild beasts, and angels waited on him. So there's three things there. The Spirit drove him out. He is tempted by Satan, and the wild beasts and angels waited on him. Now, you want to talk about a strange verse, okay? The Spirit drove him out. The word is ekbalo. Balo, you're familiar with, a ball. Ek out, something that is thrown out, okay? The Spirit pushes Jesus into the wilderness to be tempted by the Hasatan. But there, Mark says, are the wild beasts. Now remember, this chaotic force sometimes is represented by the sea monster, but sometimes it's characterized by wild beasts when you're in the wilderness. Why is it a wild beast in the wilderness? There's no water in the wilderness, right? Okay, so the image changes a little bit. What is Mark trying to tell us? That there are moments in life when we feel we are being attacked. Are these literal wild beasts out in the wilderness? Possibly. But it seems as though Mark is playing on this overall theme that has been brought from the Old Testament into his moment. Mark is the earliest gospel written, and he chooses to emphasize the wild beasts. Was Jesus fighting off lions and tigers and bears, oh my? Probably not. This is probably communicating those moments in life where spiritually it feels as though you're wrestling with the beasts of life. And so here, is the temptation. Will Jesus give up? Will Jesus give in? Will Jesus become accusatory of God not treating him right? Accusation, it seems to me, becomes the dragon's scheme. Just look around the world. We're always accusing someone of something. And it's kind of a way of justifying ourselves or protecting ourselves, that type of thing. But if we can keep in mind here that God is with us, and if we can realize that these wild beasts might be figurative of some of the forces that are trying to throw us out into the world to compromise our commitment to God, I think we're onto something there. But God does not leave us alone. The angels came to minister to him. Somehow, God gives us the strength to take the next step. God does not leave us alone. And the angels provide Jesus the strength to fight off these draconian thoughts and emotions when you spend 40 days all alone in a wilderness-like setting. So maybe the dragon is the craftiest of serpents, where on a daily basis, the temptation is to deceive and tempt and lie and backstab or bring accusation against other people as a way of protecting ourselves, rather than realizing that God is with us. Maybe dragon schemes is how we destroy ourselves in the process because we distrust God or distrust each other. I read for you earlier out of the book of Hebrews that we have a great and merciful high priest who shares in our flesh and blood, who's tempted in every way as we are. But he becomes this high priest that says, come near. Let us draw near, the writer Hebrews says, to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need.